This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ. إِلَّا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favour after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The US House Speaker reiterates Washington's support for Taiwan, while China condemns her visit to Taipei, saying those who play with fire will perish by it. Russia warns it could use its nuclear arsenal in response to direct involvement of NATO countries over the Ukraine conflict. And the leader of Hezbollah slabs US empty promises for supplying natural gas and electricity to Lebanon, saying nothing has happened after a year. For joining us. Our top story this hour, US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who's on a visit to Taiwan, says her country won't abandon its commitment to the self-ruled island.
Today, our delegation, which I'm very proud, came to Taiwan to make unequivocally clear we will not abandon our commitment to Taiwan, and we are proud of our enduring friendship.
Pelosi says the message of her trip is that America's solidarity with Taiwan is crucial. She was speaking after talks with Taiwan's president. Tsai Ing-wen said the island will not back down as China geared up for military drills in response to Pelosi's trip. Beijing denounced the visit immediately after Pelosi landed in Taipei on Tuesday evening.
Today, our delegation, which I'm very proud,
the United States constantly distorts, obscures, and hollows out the One China principle. These moves, like playing with fire, are extremely dangerous. Those who play with fire will perish by it.
China also has vowed targeted military actions in response to Pelosi's visit. She's the highest-ranking American official to visit Taiwan in 25 years. Beijing considers the island as part of its territory and says it will one day join the motherland. China is strongly opposed to U.S. military and political support for Taiwan, saying it emboldens pro-independence forces there. Political analyst Gindo Zhou earlier joined us from Beijing. We talked to him about China's warning over Pelosi's visit and asked him why Beijing is so furious about the trip. Let's take a listen to his comments.
Well, I think, you know, the warning basically said that it's not only about Pelosi's visit alone here. Since Trump's time, actually, we see the U.S. has gradually been undoing this one China principle, which is a commitment from the U.S. side to China. This one China principle is also the political foundation of the normalization of relations between China and the United States. In 1979, U.S. President Jimmy Carter announced the establishment of diplomatic relations between U.S. and China. In that announcement, which was live on TV at that time, he made it very clear the U.S. will not develop official relationship with Taiwan anymore as part of this one China pledge. You know, you see, what we are seeing is the U.S. Growing betrayal of their commitment to China. And then that is obviously damaging the foundation of conducting normal relationship between the two countries. That's why the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said that, you know, the U.S. credibility is in crisis, has gone bankrupt, obviously, with this visit, you know. So I think China's warning is that, you know, there is a danger, there's a serious danger. And do we need another, say, could it be like World War III? You know, people are talking about that. Another war in this region, another crisis in this region. Well, the world is filled with multiple crises right now. Again, it shows the irresponsibility of Washington, the irresponsibility of Pelosi, including the Biden administration.
Moving on, Russia has accused NATO countries of what it calls a fierce hybrid confrontation against the country that Moscow says dangerously balances on the edge of an open military clash. Russia says it stands for preventing the clash, but it will not back down if the West tries to test Moscow's resolve. Those comments were made by a Russian senior foreign ministry official at the UN Nuclear Non-Proliferation Conference. Alexander Trofimov also said that the conflict in Ukraine does not warrant Russia's use of nuclear weapons. But he added Moscow could use its arsenal in response to direct aggression by NATO. Meantime, the Russian Defense Ministry has accused the U.S. of direct involvement in the Ukraine war. The ministry has referred to the comments by a Ukrainian official about the way Kiev had used Washington's HIMARS rocket system launches based on real-time information. Russia's energy giant Gazprom has halted gas supply to Latvia, adding it to the list of countries that have been excluded from Russian gas. Gazprom, in a statement, said Riga was violating supply conditions. Latvia, like Poland, Bulgaria, Finland, the Netherlands and Denmark, needs to either abide by Moscow's conditions or seek alternatives to Russian gas.
Natural gas is one of several commodities massively impacted by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The European Union receives about 40% of its natural gas from Russian pipelines, about a quarter of which flow through Ukraine. And now, in light of sanctions raised against Moscow and the months-long war, energy truly seems to be at the front and center of the conflict. Natural gas prices reached record highs in October 2021, and prices have kept climbing since hitting a new all-time high in March. Prices on the Dutch TTF hub, a European benchmark for natural gas trading, more than tripled between February 16 and March 7 before pulling back. Russia has been accused of using its natural gas as an economic and political bargaining chip. But despite all this, natural gas has continued to flow to Europe, except for a few extreme cases. An example of this would be Germany accusing Moscow of engaging in power play over energy exports. This as Germany, which imports 40% of its gas from Russia, sanctioned Moscow and is now facing record inflation in light of surging prices. Now Latvia has joined Poland, Bulgaria, Finland, Netherlands and Denmark in being cut off from Russian gas. Gazprom says it has halted gas supplies to Riga in light of their violation of supply conditions. While Russia did not specify the violations, it had already cut off gas supplies to the other countries for refusing to pay in ruble. Riga had already decided to ban Russian gas imports from January 2023, And last week, it even said it was not buying Russian gas from Gazprom. And on Saturday, Latvia said that Gazprom's decision would have little effect on the country. But while many European countries have expressed similar remarks in light of Russia's bans and rises in energy prices, their decisions seem to be going against their national interests, mainly as they have made such remarks while failing to find alternatives to cheap Russian gas. So what seems to be the case is a political decision at the expense of the people who have thus far incurred the unbearable rising costs of living.
Well, no, there is a very high stakes game of geopolitical poker going on here, and Europe does need Russian gas. At the same time, these countries, many of them, I mean, Latvia, Poland, Bulgaria, are in the forefront, Poland, in the forefront of countries that want to defeat Russia, basically. I mean, they believe they have the moral high ground, that they have a good cause, but they really want to stick it to Russia. That is their goal.
Shortly after Russia's military offensive in Ukraine, Western countries began imposing economic sanctions on Moscow. But now Europe's ambitions of securing new energy sources seem to have been scrambled to stave off a crisis.
Russia is the largest exporter of natural gas globally and the second largest producer behind the US. For decades, Russian natural gas has powered European homes and industries. In 1968, Austria and the Soviet Union signed a gas deal, and in the early 70s, natural gas shipments began arriving in West Germany. But in 1981, CIA intelligence assessment of a proposed 3,000-mile-long natural gas pipeline from Siberia to Western Germany warned of a trouble ahead. It said the pipeline would be a reliable source of gas for the continent, but would also give the Soviets political leverage over Europe. Now those problems are ringing true. But only since EU and the US have sanctioned Russia, leaving Russia with no choice but to exert energy pressure on Europe. As Russia tightens its chokehold on supplies of natural gas, Europe is looking everywhere for alternatives. Coal is back on the table and deals are being struck with new partners. Despite all this, fears are growing across the continent that a Russian gas cutoff will force governments to ration fuel, risking both jobs and people's lives. Now the race to find alternatives to Russian gas has accelerated, but the question remains as to what happens if the economies tank badly, as they seem to be, and no alternatives are found. Will the EU unity against Russia fall apart?
I do not know the answer to that. Certainly, this puts great stress on European unity. In the long term, there are alternatives to Russian energy. Although Russia, you know, it's attached to Europe, it's part of the greater Eurasia region, and it is a source of not just gas and oil, but many, many other raw materials, which are now being cut off, and Europe and Russia are having a really painful divorce, and it's the Europeans. Governments mean for Russia to suffer the pain, but in fact, in a form of blowback, they are suffering it too.
Indications that such unity is bound to fall apart are already emerging. Some EU leaders are already calling for a reconsideration in the bloc strategies. Some have even labeled Europe's attempts of replacing Russian gas as being on a knife on edge. But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way, and experts say their problems may only worsen in the future.
The leader of Hezbollah resistance movement has slammed the US's empty promises for the transfer of natural gas and electricity from Egypt and Jordan to Lebanon. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said 1 year has passed since the U.S. ambassador's promise, but nothing has happened in practice. He added that the movement had proposed to buy fuel from Iran to meet Lebanon's energy needs, but the U.S. did not allow it to happen. Nasrallah said the United States and Israel are the embodiments of the devil, and Hezbollah's struggle against them will continue. Nasrallah's remarks came 2 days after he issued a stern warning to Israel about exploiting Lebanon's offshore energy resources. Nasrallah said the resistance movement is ready for any scenario, including a war, to protect those resources. The dispute between Lebanon and Israel escalated in early June after the regime sent a drilling ship to the Karish gas field in the Mediterranean. Lebanon dismisses Israel's claim that the field falls within its so-called exclusive economic zone. The U.S. says it's selling new missile defense systems to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates worth more than $5 billion. The State Department says Saudi Arabia will buy 300 units of Patriot missile systems, which can be used to shoot down long-range ballistic missiles and aircraft. The Saudi order is worth over $3 billion, according to the department. New missiles will be used to defend Saudi Arabia against drone and missile attacks from Yemen. Separately, the UAE is buying $2.25 billion worth of THAAD missile systems. Both countries have been targets of retaliatory attacks by Yemeni forces. And finally, Iran's capital Tehran has hosted the 7th Islamic Human Rights Awards. The event seeks to honor those who have contributed to human rights around the world. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has more.
The top prize of the Islamic Human Rights Awards goes to Shirin Abu Akla. The former Al Jazeera journalist was shot dead by Israeli forces back in May while reporting Tel Aviv's atrocities against Palestinians. Her name echoed in the 7th edition of Islamic Human Rights and Dignity Awards. Shirin was awarded for her vital role in shining a light on the Palestinian cause in her on-the-scene reports from the occupied territories.
Shirin was killed by an Israeli bullet. There's also criticism directed at the U.S. Israel is pushing the United States to avoid introducing the Tel Aviv regime as the killer of Shirin Abu Akleh. But we at Al Jazeera will continue our investigation of the case to bring her assassin to justice.
Another winner of the Islamic Human Rights Awards was Mandla Mandela, the grandson of former South African President Nelson Mandela. Mandla, who is now serving as a member of South Africa's National Assembly, won the award for his active role in opposing the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The
Palestinian issue is of greatest importance to us, as we have seen the atrocities that are being meted out against defenseless children, women, who are languishing in Israeli jails, as well as Palestinians in general. And we continue to expose the apartheid regime of Israel as carrying out crimes against humanity and genocide against the Palestinian people.
Organized by the Iranian Judiciary's Human Rights Committee, the event was held on the occasion of the 32nd anniversary of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam. In 1990, member states of the Organization of the Islamic Conference assembled in Cairo and laid out a new human rights charter that sought to ensure man's freedom and right to dignity in accordance with Islamic laws.
Activists here say the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights states that every human being, regardless of race and religion, has the right to a dignified life, something which they say the West has so far not lived up to.
Observers say the West, and on top of them the U.S., maintains a selective approach toward human rights, to an extent that it violates even its own principles of human rights.
For example, you see that in Canada, how they are treating the indigenous people. They are their own people, and the laws are violated. Or in the United States, so you see that how they are treating with the blacks. So they are also, again, their own people. So for them, it doesn't matter whether it is Islamic human rights or the international human rights or the Western human rights principles.
The imposition of sanctions as a punishing leverage is another example cited by participants here as a blatant violation of human rights by Washington.
The sanctions that have been imposed on the Islamic Republic are secondary sanctions imposed by the United States, not by the United Nations. South Africa itself does not observe these sanctions. We don't recognize them.
Participants say the Islamic narrative of human rights is not meant to be a counterpoint to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it seeks to safeguard the rights of Muslims against any misuse by countries such as the U.S., which looks at the issue through the lens of its political interests. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Many thanks for tuning in.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Imam Hussein in the eyes of Sunni thinkers. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein's personality and movement has astounded every seeker of freedom from any creed. Many scholars and thinkers have spoken on Imam Hussein and the Epic of Ashura during the past 14 centuries. In a few episodes, we are going to dwell upon the words and views of four Sunni thinkers who love Hussein, and have expressed their pure love in their works. Stay tuned, please. Abdurrahman al-Sharqawi was an Egyptian thinker, writer, journalist, poet, and dramatist. He was born in 1920 and was graduated in law in 1943. He worked as a lawyer for 2 years and then as an inspector for several years. This contemporary thinker then turned to writing dramas. Al-Sharqawi used to mix his dramas with poem. He wrote a piece on Imam Hussein, peace upon him, which was a brief account of the great epic of Ashura and the events after it. He has tried in the drama to express the political and social realities of his time and to show the way to resist against them. This way, he tries to make people understand the value of freedom and dignity. Al-Sharqawi believes that Imam Hussein, peace upon him, does not belong only to Shias, but to the whole mankind. He says, Hussein, peace upon him, is the martyr of religion and freedom. Not only Shias should be proud of him, but all free-spirited people in the world should take pride in his noble name. Al-Sharqawi was very successful in explicating Imam Hussein's personality and movement. He was among the Sunni writers who have conveyed the Imam's message beautifully to the reader. Perhaps one of the most beautiful parts of his dramas is related to the internal conflict of Hur, the commander of Ibn Ziyad's troops. Al-Sharqawi elaborately depicts Hur's verbal conflict with his senior commander, Umar Sa'd. Umar Sa'd asks him to stay without unsheathingly his sword. This way, he could keep his face among both groups. But Hur answers him that he couldn't serve two commanders and he wanted to choose between his conscience and his commander. The Egyptian thinker and dramatist Abdurrahman al-Sharqawi has tried in his poetical drama to show Imam Hussein's motive of his uprising against Yazid. He also tries to awaken his society through explicating Imam Hussein's character. He has versified some lines as if the Imam had told them. Part of his poems read, Remember me as you will find every virtue in me. I am the lonely who has been wronged. Now time has turned in a way that there remain only vices and praiseworthy virtues have perished. So remember me while courage has blended with idiocy and benefit has become the criterion for honesty and eloquent orators are like those who have failed to speak. When you behold silence against deception or witness submission to humility, do know that I will be beheaded again, and I will plunge in my blood thousands of times every day. Yes, they keep beheading me so long as a group is living in humility and disgrace. As long as a man like Yazid rules them and he does whatever he wishes, as long as the time is such, the martyr's wound will curse you as you have not learned his message. So reach the martyr's blood.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby.
Hussein, 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 Hussein. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you. I cry for you in
the story of Masoud and Saddam.
Part 2.
Upon his arrival in Iraq in 1986, Masoud Rajavi was received warmly by the ruling Ba'ath Party. It was at this point that Saddam Hussein and Masoud Rajavi started a lifelong friendship, one that heralded a new chapter for the Iraqi people. At the time, no one could even imagine that the presence of a terrorist organization headed by Masoud Rajavi would have such disastrous consequences for the Iraqi citizens. Shoring up Rajavi's fragile group and providing him with military facilities to establish a small but independent army on Iraqi soil, Saddam Hussein was in fact helping Rajavi fulfill his dream of becoming the president of Iran. But Rajavi's assault to take Tehran was a non-starter. His army was dealt heavy losses in what Iran called Operation Mursad. This was the last major military operation of the Iran-Iraq War, ending in a decisive victory for Iran unable to take Tehran, the defeated army had to remain in Iraq, an albatross around the neck of the Ba'ath Party. As the Iraqi war in Iran drew to an end with no significant achievement for the Iraqi strongmen, signs of despair and distrust began to bubble up in the rank and file of the Ba'ath army, bringing the country to the verge of a revolt against Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. But the dictator's scheme saved his power. At Saddam Hussein's order, the Ba'ath military camps received Rajavi's group between 1988 and 1991. The aim was to give the MKO members special military training with modern weapons. At the time, no one knew when and where the training and the weapons would be used. Not only did the Mujahideen-e Khalq organization resemble the Ba'ath Party in appearance, also efforts were made to inculcate into the members the idea that ordinary people would be enemy number one for them. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. He wanted to compensate for heavy losses he had incurred in his 8-year-old war in Iran, and also to find a way out for the country's deteriorating economy. But the dictator made miscalculations. All his once Western and Arab supporters stood against him. He was doomed to defeat in this war as well. On March 3, 1991, one day after the Persian Gulf War ceasefire, a T-72 tank gunner, returning home after Iraq's defeat in Kuwait, fired a shell into a colossal portrait of Saddam Hussein hanging over Basra's main square. The revolt in Basra was first led by Colonel Mohammad Ibrahim Wali, an Iraqi army officer. He attacked some government buildings and prisons in the city. Backed by a majority of the population, the uprising led to the fall of Basra into the hands of the dissidents. On the same day, in Najaf, a demonstration near Imam Ali Mosque became a gun battle between army deserters and Saddam's security forces. People seized control of the city. The uprising spread within days to all of the big Shia cities in South Iraq. Amara, Diwaniya, Hilla, Karbala, Kut, Nasiriyah, and Samawa. Now, the initial protests had turned into a widespread uprising in which both Shia and Sunni Muslims stood side by side against the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. 3 days after the start of the uprising in the south, which was also referred to as the Sha'ban Intifada due to its concurrence with the month of Sha'ban, another wave of insurgency broke out in the Kurdish-populated areas in the north. The situation had spun out of control. The intelligence service and the army seemed impotent in the face of such big an event. The dictator was in danger of collapse. But one thing changed the course of history. The so-called National Liberation Army of Iran, commanded by Masoud Rajavi, an army Saddam Hussein had long counted on. When the uprising began, Masoud Rajavi was located in a base called Light One in Karbala. The fall of Saddam Hussein meant the fall of him and his organization. Soon after, he deployed his task forces to Basra to infiltrate the people so as to identify the leaders of the uprising. Along with a number of his intelligence agents, Masoud headed for Camp Ashraf in Diyala, in the north of Baghdad. Because they were Iranian nationals, the MKO members could go freely among the ordinary people and revolutionaries. Therefore, they handed in the names of prominent revolutionaries along with their addresses to the Iraqi intelligence service, known also as the Mukhabarat. Within a short span of time, the leaders of the revolution were arrested and sentenced to death in the worst ways possible, including throwing off a height, beheading, being cut into pieces in big industrial meat grinders, being dissolved in sulfuric acid, and being blown up with TNT in their pockets. Those killed during the uprisings were among the luckiest. The other group had a fate worse than death. They were subjected to brutal tortures. Their fate had to be a salutary lesson. Breaking arms and fingers were among the simplest tortures in the Ba'ath prisons during the crackdown on the 1991 uprisings in Iraq. All that was possible with the help of Saddam Hussein's private army. That's the MKO, headed by Masoud Rajavi. The help the MKO gave Saddam Hussein was not limited to identifying the leaders of the 1991 uprisings. After the suppression of the uprisings, they paved the way for the Ba'ath army to enter the city of Karbala. In the conflict between the people and the MKO forces in Karbala, three forces who were among MKO's special agents were killed by the people. These three were later buried in Marvarid Ashraf Cemetery. The three were the whole casualties of the MKO during the 1991 uprisings. But there are still thousands of people unaccounted for. They disappeared during the uprisings. Years later, 3 days after the fall of Saddam Hussein, the faint glimmer of hope to find them blew out, as there was nothing to be found about them in the remaining documents in Abu Ghraib prison.
Thank you.
The discovered mass graves only revealed the fate of a number of these disappeared citizens. Many families were still waiting to hear about their missing members. That's why the MKO-TV claimed that more than 5 million Iraqi people have signed a petition calling for the MKO to be granted freedom of action in Iraq. When the BBC called the petition a fraud, the organization sarcastically labeled the news network Ayatollah BBC. In a report commissioned by the Pentagon, Rand Corporation, a non-profit institute, writes that the signatures are falsified. The 1991 uprisings in the South were suppressed with the help of the MKO. But their next mission in the North was much more horrifying. Rajavi's army, as the most equipped unit in Saddam Hussein's Greater Army, undertook a mission that later came to be known as the Anfal Genocide. Those who spend years in these prisons have not forgotten tortures by the Ba'ath interrogators. The 1991 uprisings in South Iraq broke out when the Ba'ath army had fallen apart after being defeated in the First Persian Gulf War. But with the great service the MKO provided Saddam Hussein with, by spying for the intelligence service and identifying the leaders of the uprisings, the popular movement soon came to an end. Once again, the Ba'ath army took control of the cities in South Iraq. Prisons became full of prisoners whose fate never came to light. The prisons of Basra and other southern cities were packed with prisoners who had been told on by MKO spies. But these prisoners were not the only victims of the MKO service to Saddam Hussein's regime. The total catastrophe for the Iraqi Kurds was on the way. A catastrophe caused again by this man and his organization, Mas'ud Rajavi and his organization called the MKO. A reportage prepared by the MKO TV states that South Iraq is under the control of rebels, alluding to the 1991 uprisings and the popular movements in that area. With the outbreak of the 1991 uprisings in the south, Kurdish fighters joined the rebellion against the Ba'ath regime. When the Ba'ath party had lost its power as a result of the defeat in the First Persian Gulf War, the fighters succeeded in controlling the heights and the Kurdish populated cities in the north. In addition, the Kurdish fighters managed to bring under control some areas in West Iraq. The streets of Khanarin were scattered with the bodies of the Ba'ath soldiers. The time was ripe for the fighters to go to Baghdad and topple the dictator. But in the absence of the Ba'ath army, there was an equipped army to block their way in North Baghdad. That army was nothing but the Mujahideen Khalq organization. The organization had been missioned to block the Kurds' way to the capital city before a complete suppression of the uprisings in the south and the arrival of Ba'ath reinforcements. On March 25, 1991, the Ba'ath military forces finally managed to completely suppress the popular movement in the south. After 2 weeks of bloodshed, and go to help the MKO. With their arrival, the military oppression against the Kurds began. It was called by Masoud Rajavi as Operation Pearl One, as it happened in the heights of the same name. Although the Kurdish fighters had been blocked on their way to Baghdad, they still had northern cities under control. At that time, the MKO had advanced on the heart of the Kurdish strongholds, and therefore had been surrounded by them. But when the Ba'ath army couldn't penetrate the Kurds, the MKO deceived them. In their own separate report, Australia's Parliamentary Committee on Foreign Relations and the U.S. State Department, as well as RAND Corporation, have revealed the role of Masoud Rajavi in the Anfal genocide and his help to keep Saddam Hussein in power. In its report, RAND refers to a statement by Rajavi encouraging the MKO forces to take the Kurds under your tanks and save your bullets for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Saddam Hussein gave Rajavi the Rafahdine Medallion, a high honor in the Iraqi military, for his role in suppressing the Kurds. The mass killing of the Kurds in the north resulted in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of the Kurds in these areas. Many Kurdish women and children lost their lives due to the cold, hunger, and difficulty of the situation. Many others went missing. A majority of them are still unaccounted for.
Destroy Saddam and his army, but he don't try. All this because he don't want Kurdish and Shia to be leader in Iraq, to run Iraq. Why he do that? He could destroy the army. We could live in peace. The war is finished. He destroyed Kuwait. Kuwait is 1 million. 1 million, he do this all war for 1 million. We are 5 million.
After the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, Iraqi prisons were the only hope for the families to find their missing members. Mass graves found in prison yards dashed the hopes of these families to find their long missing members. suppressing, quelling the 1991 uprisings, and playing a central role in the Amphal genocide. Masoud Rajavi helped the Iraqi dictator remain in power for another 12 years. In return, Saddam Hussein gave him a free rein in his territory.
Saddam's regime is over.
In 2003, the Iraqi people saw a day when the country's dictator was finally arrested. He was put on trial for the mass killing of the Iraqi people and then sentenced to death. But no one asked about his right-hand man in committing crimes against the Iraqis. Masoud Rajavi disappeared in the chaos of falling Saddam Hussein. Rajavi knew well that Saddam Hussein's fate could be his. Camp Ashraf, November 2013. Long after the fall of Saddam Hussein, the MKO members remained in Camp Ashraf under the protection of the U.S. forces while trying to show legitimate their presence on the Iraqi soil. Now years have passed. It's been years since the presence of Masoud Rajavi in Iraq, and Camp Ashraf has turned into a ghost city. The MKO members couldn't justify their presence in Iraq anymore. Evacuating the camp, they moved under the protection of the U.S. forces to a camp in Baghdad called Liberty, where their cost of living is paid out of the Iraqi people's pockets and where they live in complete security. Who knows? Perhaps Masoud Rajavi and his terrorist organization have been saved by the powers that be to be hired once again in the future.
In the limelight.
It is natural for Iran and China to further strengthen their age-old bilateral ties through cooperation in all fields, including the 25-year accord that guarantees the development of the two countries and makes them immune from the extraterritorial sanctions of a fast-declining U.S. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, International Staff Writer. This article is published under the heading, A Strengthening of Iran-China Ties, Beneficial for the Free World. Here's the story.
Thank you.
Iran and China were cradles of civilization, enjoying bilateral ties when the Greeks were beginning to discover civilized life and the Romans were centuries away from culture, while Europeans inhabiting the regions north of Alps, including the British Isles and the Nordic lands, were no more than barbarians. On the other side of the world, North America was almost a barren land of primitive people. Over a millennium and a half later, in 1776, when the 13 New England colonies, peopled by European invaders who decimated the native Amerindians, declared independence from London as the United States of America, Iran was administered by the enlightened statesman Karim Khan Zand and was held in awe by the Ottomans and the Franks, although he never took the title of Shah. China, for its part, was then ruled by the powerful Qianlong Emperor, who enjoyed diplomatic ties with Iran. And although he suppressed Chinese Muslims in fear of the spread of the teachings of Islam, he disdainfully termed the English merchants as barbarians on being requested to grant an island for trading, saying, "The inventors of gunpowder and paper do not need Europe."